This is a segment from the Annex Sociology Podcast. For more information, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
Okay, so I've got an item, which, like all of my best items, is, you know, stated in the form of a gripe. So as longtime listeners might remember, in like one of the very first episodes, I had like a list of things I dislike about R, although ironically, I've been spending almost all my time in R since then. My item is, I sat down and calculated it, and during this month, I have the month of April 2018, I have approximately 110 hours of service, most of it peer review to the discipline. Now, some of that is like a, you know, kind of a single item that got dropped on me. And, you know, it's cool and it's important to do, but it got me thinking, not just to complain and not say, woe is me, you know, send flowers to 264 Haynes Hall, Los Angeles, California, 90095. But, you know, I just thinking in just a broader sense, because I realize everybody does this, or at least in certain sectors of the discipline, everybody does this. And there's other people who have it worse than I do, maybe not in this particular month, but overall, I definitely have it better than my department chair. And overall, I, like most other white guys, have it better than most women and ethnic minorities who, as a general rule, do more service, in part because people are especially solicitous of their opinions. Thanks for the, you know, the favor, you know, but of course that implies a, you know, burdening them with extra service. So, you know, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, like, a lot of this stuff is not an efficient use of people's time, and it's not an efficient use of the discipline's time. Like, and if we were somehow pricing this or thinking about it rationally or rationally maximizing it, we wouldn't do it this way. So a good portion of this, my time, is this month, is taken up by being on a prize jury for one of the section awards. And, you know, we're organizing it pretty efficiently. We're having two people read each book rather than having all the members of the committee read all the books. And then, right, you know, we're developing a short list, which is about as efficient as you could do that. But then I was thinking, like, you know, how many sections are there in the ASA? Basically, all of them have a book prize. That's actually a lot of service work. And as somebody who's studied prizes, I know that, you know, from James English's excellent book, Economy of Prestige, one of the things that people systematically underestimate when they set up a prize is they think the cost of the prize is the value of the prize award, right? They think the cost of the prize is the cost of the trophy or the $500 check or whatever, and they don't realize that that is nothing compared to the labor that goes into judging a prize. Particularly if it's, you know, if it's like looking at paintings or something, that's not necessarily that much. You can look at a painting for 30 seconds and, you know, say next. But, you know, for something like books or movies, right, that takes hours per entrant to judge it. And people systematically undervalue this, and they usually don't budget for it explicitly. They usually have the idea that it'll be done as volunteer labor, which it is. And it's kind of funny because, like, you know, I had done a prize before, and I was at a council meeting for a section council at ASA this last summer, and somebody's like, oh, let's create a new prize. And I raised the objection. I said, you realize that you're committing to section members doing the labor to judge this prize. And that's going to be time consuming. And then somebody's like, oh, no, that's right. There's plenty of people who want opportunities to be involved. And I'm thinking, like, well, that's funny, because how come they don't do it when people ask me to do it? You know? But I'm also thinking, like, you know, even if that's true, even if there's people who want or like looking for opportunities to get involved in the section, and, you know, bluntly, this is very often junior career women. You know, how much of a responsibility do section officers have to kind of take a paternalistic thing of saying, I know you want to help, and that's wonderful that you want to help, but write your papers, right? That would be a better use of your time and would advance you in the discipline more than, you know, you taking on this huge service responsibility that, you know, it's very generous of you to want to do, but it ultimately, you know, write your papers instead. And so let's not create this. But, you know, given that there were people, you know, willing to do it, and the council meeting was running long, I wasn't going to say, no, I'm not going to let you judge this prize that you're volunteering for.
Filibuster it.
Yeah, exactly. Although, you know, if I had a stronger stand on principle, I would have said, you know, here I stand, I can do no other. No more service work for anyone, even if it's not going to me. So, you know, like, right, section prizes are an example of something where, you know, there's obviously an upside, right? It creates a reputational boost to the person who wins it, which can be especially valuable if it's an early career person, and that can help them in their career. It also can be of some value to the people reading about the prize because they can learn about a book that, you know, or an article that they will then read that'll be more enlightening to them than the next best article they could have read. You know, and I can think of personal cases where, like, I've learned about something interesting because of a prize, right? I first met Charlie Seguin after I was, I think it was Social Culture, the student paper prize. I read his paper on kind of the mathematics of the superstar effect, and I loved it. And so I met Charlie after that. And so I'm very glad for that. But kind of overall, I'm not sure if the benefits outweigh the costs, in part because we don't really consider the cost.
Yeah, it's also like the people who should be doing the job are those whose nests are already feathered, in a sense, right? Like, it should be done by people who are tenured, but, and I mean, you'll have some tenured faculty who want to keep on contributing to the discipline and want to stay active, but there's also a sizable part of our profession who might check out and they'll say to themselves, why should I do anything? I already have tenure. And you're sort of in a catch-22. Yeah.
Well, I am tenured, but I still think the discipline would be better off with me spending the month of April writing papers than, you know, spending it all on review.
Leslie, you've done book review prizes. What do you have to say about this?
I've done so much service. It is unbelievable. And I'm talking as junior faculty, right? And not just for the discipline, which, you know, I was dissertation award chair, grad student paper award, head of my section, right? Lots of reviews, you know, and that's just for the discipline. Like then there's my university, and at my university level, right, you know, I've been on searches for X, Y, and Z dean. I'm on the faculty senate. I'm on the faculty senate steering committee. I am on two ad hoc committees of the senate steering committee, right? And that's just, I'm on two different presidential committees, right, that have to do with two totally different subjects. And then there's my department level work, right? And I don't even want to get into that. So, it's crazy. So I hear you in talking about April being this crazy month, but this is my every single month of the academic year. And then over the summer is when I really, really, really then end up doing a lot of labor for the discipline. Yeah. So, and it's not a matter of me seeking out these opportunities. Yeah. I don't want those opportunities, right? And I think especially at the departmental and university level, it's more of a people come to you and you ask yourself, who can I say no to? Right. Who can I say no to? And, you know, I'm sorry to say, I mean, I think that there is this idea that junior faculty are protected by their departments, right? To make sure that, like, okay, we're not going to give you too much service. We're also going to make sure that we block the university. But you know what? That depends on what department you're in. It really, really depends. And if I hear one more person try and say, well, I understand that this is something that happens to women and minorities, but, you know, luckily I was savvy enough not to get pulled into it. You weren't savvy enough. You had someone who protected you. That's all I got to say.
If we take the Dr. Seuss perspective, if I ran the zoo, said young Gerald McGrew, I'd make a few changes. That's just what I do. What are the changes, right? Where would be areas that we could cut these things down? So, like, as implied, I think one easy change would be to have fewer awards, right? You know, I think there should be, like, you know, there should be an ASA dissertation prize. I think that that's a great idea. But I don't think every, you know, we have 800 sections and all of them have a book prize. I don't think that's an efficient use of the university's time. When somebody goes up for tenure, I think maybe there should be 5 external letters, not 10. Right. I think maybe we should get rid of this expectation that a journal article will be reviewed by 4 people per round of review. And we should have more up and down review and usually only reviewed by 2 people. So I mean, any objections to any of that? Well, or then... other things that it sounds like Leslie's problem is not peer. My problem is mostly peer review. of various forms. It sounds like Leslie's is basically the University Commission on X. So what would you change about the University Commission on X so that you could actually, you know, write your next book?
I think two things. I think that there should be a fairness rule, right? You know what I mean? It's like, okay, the people with the most to lose should be the ones who do the least amount of service, right? And that should be across the board. And it doesn't matter that we only have like five faculty of color, right? That doesn't mean that you get like the one junior faculty of color at the university to be on every single committee where you think you need someone to do that, right? And I think that should just be a rule. And I think it's so interesting. I think there are so many parallels in many ways that we've been seeing with the whole Me Too movement and people talking about, you know, sort of quid pro quo sex, right? I kind of feel like in my situation, it's been this kind of like this quid pro quo, you do service, right? We'll make sure that we'll maybe vote for you, you know, in your tenure case.
I totally sympathize with what you're saying that, you know, if you have five women and 50 men, but you still want a gender balanced perspective on something, or you have five black professors and everybody else is white, and you still want, input from black faculty, then, you know, you should say like, well, at a certain point, you just got to say no. But of course, we all know what would happen then, which is, you know, people would complain, not necessarily the professors who finally get to go back to their office and write their books, which we'd all enjoy reading, hopefully not for a prize, just because that's great research that we want to cite. But, you know, we would see people saying like, oh, this commission didn't, you know, is on issue X and it didn't have any women on it. Look at this picture of the committee, right? And we've all seen stuff like that circulating on Twitter. You know, you can understand why people want that and to a certain extent why in some respects it might even be a good idea. So I'm thinking like I'm sympathetic with that idea of just saying like, it doesn't matter if, you know, this means that this committee won't have any women or will only have white people or whatever on it, that it's like in order to protect those faculty so that they can get tenure by doing research, protect them. Maybe it should be that, like, you know, kind of a middle ground would be if you're going to give somebody a big service obligation, you have to give them a course release to compensate them for that.
Exactly.
And that would do two things. Number one is that it would still let, you know, if, you know, the university decides that, you know, we really need Leslie to be on this committee because we don't have any other black faculty or any other women or whatever who can do it, you know, so it's really essential. Okay, well, fine, then she'll still get to write her book. But the other thing it would do is it would put a cost on making committees. And if, you know, the assistant vice dean for, you know, Hassel decides to create a committee and appoint a bunch of faculty to it, then the assistant vice dean for Hassel would have to pay for that, right? And once you make people pay for things, they'll do less of it. And they'll actually realize there's a cost and economize, right? So it both help the faculty actually do their research, especially those faculty who are most impacted by service, you know, and then it would also cut down on the service just naturally by pricing it.
I have a bit of a different point of view on all of this, though, and it has more to do with the supply of labor rather than demands that are being put on the labor pool. There are hundreds of academic sociologists in Metro New York, and the vast majority of them, they're not part of the ESA, they're not part of a section, they're probably teaching, you know, a 3-3, but they're just not engaged and they're not available to the discipline, let's say. And part of it is that most schools don't reimburse ASA, you know, dues, and the dues are very expensive for someone who might be earning 45, 50 grand a year, you know, or the ASA can feel like some people as a closed shop. I don't know if it is in reality, if people are just intimidated or, but in any case, there's a lot of underutilized labor as is. And it seems to me that the people who are publishing are also the people who tend to be on the ASA committees, and you know, there's workflows to the people who are active, right? You want something done, give it to a busy person. And I feel like we could engage a lot of unutilized labor. What do you think of that?
Yeah, so this is an area where I'm just going to be blatantly elitist and say that, like, the problem with that is that if you give a bunch of, say, peer review responsibilities to people who don't publish very much, they're going to have bad taste in what to publish. And, you know, and there's a lot of sociologists who, you know, their syllabus is like nothing but articles from Salon.com.
Okay, and, fine, but all right.
But I mean, that's where the, you know, the slack is, you know, and so if you use all this like unused labor, people who are like enthusiastic about helping, but, you know, and everything, and you send articles from ASR to them, you know, and it's some article that's, you know, doing an exponential random graph model of, you know, this or that. First of all, they're not going to be able to judge it, right? Because they're not doing that kind of research. And second of all, they just won't find it interesting because it's not engaging with essentially moral questions that are of more interest to them than the very kind of technical mechanistic questions that you see. There's a huge divide between elite journal sociology and kind of like everyday teaching sociology. And you're essentially talking about bringing those people in. The vast majority of the service to the discipline is peer review. But, you know, precisely because there's that gulf, you know, those people wouldn't really, or at least most of them, I'm sure there's plenty of people in there, but the vast majority of them wouldn't really fit with judging that style of research. And I know that's really elitist, and a lot of people are going to be pissed off, but I don't care. You know,
I think I'm somewhere in between the two of you, right? So, Joe, I definitely do believe that there's a lot of underutilized talent out there, right? At the same time, I also somewhat agree with Gabriel in that, you know, not everyone is talent in this respect. But I do actually think that I think a lot of the same people are being asked over and over and over again to review articles. And that's not fair to that person. Neither is it fair to the people whose papers they're reviewing, right? Because that person might publish in that area, might use this kind of a model, doesn't necessarily mean that that one person is going to be great for every single one of those articles, right? And so I do think that we do have like a little bit of this kind of incestuous thing going on, in terms of, you know, who gets published through which venue, who then gets to review, right? I don't know. I think we need to mix it up a little bit more. And I think that there are people out there, you know, who, even if they aren't like, you know, even if they aren't publishing in AJS and ASR, actually might be really, really good readers.
Well, I think so too. Well, first of all, we can differentiate between reviewing for ASR and reviewing for a section book prize and, you know, other types of content review. I think a lot of people who are active, unquote, and publishing, unquote, are doing a lot of business in semantic games and things that I personally don't feel very valuable. Are very valuable. And I'm also of the opinion that a really good piece of science can be understood by any intelligent person, should be comprehensible, you know, by any intelligent, well-educated person. And some people just aren't good at writing, but they're quite intelligent. Now, that's not to say that everybody has a deep statistical knowledge and can, you know, judge every single paper out there, but there, I don't think that I think that there's far more people who could capably judge a student paper prize, who could capably judge a book that is intended for a mass audience in some level, and they're not just being pulled into the fray. There's lots of smart people in this business.
You know, there's two ways to address this problem, because, you know, I was framing this not as poor me, I have too much work to do. You know, and I was explicitly acknowledging that there's other people who have it worse, and it's systematic in terms of who has it even worse. I was thinking of it as like a lot of this just doesn't need to be done. And, you know, it's stuff that is very often nice to be done, but there could be ways to economize on labor. And some of the things like inevitably have to be done by elites, right? You're not going to have, you know, schools sending out external review letters to faculty at institutions that are lower ranked than the school performing the review, right? It's just the custom that it has to be somebody at that rate, at that level or higher. You know, unless there's some question that the only other expert in this esoteric subject matter is at Podunk State. Right. So, you know, but I so you guys, I hear you saying like, you know, I hear Leslie saying like, well, we could distribute it more evenly. And I hear Joe saying like, well, here's this pool of untapped labor. And I'm saying like, let's just do less of it, period. Right. And let's really think about for any given bit of service work, any bit of review, does this really need to be done? Do we really need a committee on X? Do we really need five peer? Do we really need a prize for this? Do we really need five peer reviewers and four rounds of R&R instead of two peer reviewers and an up or down?
Oh, no. The sociological science model is the best model, in my opinion. Like, I love that model.
I do a lot of service for sociological science, but I don't mind doing it for sociological science because it's efficient for the discipline as a whole, right? A lot of my reviewing time is for social science because I'm on the board, but I think it's great because it requires, I almost don't care how much work I'm doing. I care how much work is being done in aggregate. And so it's like, even though it's more work for me to review for social science than it is sociological science is to review for another journal occasionally, I feel like it's a more efficient use of the discipline's time in the aggregate because sociological science does use far less reviewer time per article than your typical journal.
Well, you also believe in the endeavor, whereas there's probably plenty of committees where you're like, what the heck is this about? But, you know, there's the flip side of that, which is that if we start doing that in the aggregate, we're going to be start having to cede decision making to somebody else. And it's going to go to university administrators, which I think is fine. But there's a lot of people who feel like university administrators are already too powerful. And that they
I agree with that.
You know,
yeah, I think that there's a lot of problems that are caused by administrative bloat. But you know, I would try and argue that there's certain things where it's like there's still faculty control. I'm not saying that you should have an assistant vice dean for peer reviewing papers for ASR, right? I'm just saying, you know, a journal can do a review with two peer reviewers and an editor rather than four peer reviewers and an editor. And you've just cut down the reviewing time, at least for the reviewer pool, by half, you know, or you can review based on one round of R&R instead of two rounds of R&R. And again, you've cut down the reviewing time by a third. You can have five external letter writers for a tenure case instead of 10. Now you've cut that labor in half.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with that.
And none of that involves delegating to administrative bloat. Maybe Leslie's issues would, you know, cutting down on faculty time would inevitably mean more, administrative power. Although not necessarily if it just reduced the amount of functions that were performed by the university.
For more, visit us on the web. TheAnnexPodcast.com.